And as always, we welcome your topic suggestions. You can email me at it's azania@702.co.za. So whatever masterclass or topic that you'd like to hear more on, you can make those suggestions via email. And today we're looking at social media, because social media has shifted the way in which we communicate. But what we don't realize is that there are a lot of severe legal implications for the things that we publish online. In today's masterclass, Emma Sadlier is my guest, and she's going to cover the safety, the legal, disciplinary and reputational risks of social media and how to protect your children and yourself in this digital age. Because the more we use social media, the more we're confronted with legal, moral, ethical questions. And we have all of these laws at play, publication laws, employment laws, defamation laws, hate laws that that are about hate speech. All these laws intersect depending on how we use social media. She's no stranger to you. Emma Sadlier is a media law consultant, and she's a speaker whose area of expertise includes all aspects of print and electronic media law, with a particular focus on defamation, privacy, and social media law. And she's an admitted attorney, and she runs her organization now, and she has published several books, including Don't Film Yourself Having Sex and Other Legal Advice for the Age of Social Media. And her latest book is going to be in stores very soon, launching next week. And it's entitled Selfies, Sexts and Smartphones, A Teenager's Online Survival Guide. I've been flipping through it. It's one that you're going to have in your house if you have children. Good afternoon, Emma. Great to see you again.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
It is such an important topic.
Yeah.
I think not enough can be said. And the more we use social media, the more we're confronted by new questions around what it means, what our posts mean, and the ramifications around it. You made a point to say that it's can be dangerous.
Well, it can be incredibly dangerous. You know, I think that for me, the biggest danger comes in with looking after our reputation. I think we've got to the point, Azza, that we're all celebrities in the digital age. Mm. And we have this online presence, which comes with us wherever we go. You know, before I meet you, I Google you, I check you out online. So I spend a lot of time working with the children, not just teaching them about what the laws are, what the disciplinary consequences can be if they get it wrong on their cell phones, but also very importantly, looking after their online CV from a young age, looking after that online reputation. It's absolutely crucial.
Yes. Now, we need to first understand that the instant a person publishes or posts something up on social media, what we're doing in essence is publishing.
Yeah.
So the same laws that, say, apply to a media house that publishes the newspaper would apply to you as well as others. As
Absolutely.
Well as many other laws.
Absolutely. So, you know, I go to cocktail parties and people say to me, oh, Emma, it must be so tricky being a social media lawyer. How do you stay on top of all the new laws? And I have to say, well, there are no new laws. You know, we treat content on social media in exactly the same way that we treat content on the front page of the newspaper. The requirement of publication for all of these publication laws that you mentioned in the introduction, that requirement of publication is met as soon as one other person has seen that content. So what that means is that we treat content on maybe a WhatsApp group to 8 people, maybe Facebook to 500 people, maybe Twitter to 50,000 people, in exactly the same way legally as if you'd published it on a billboard or published it on the front page of the newspaper or said it on your show this afternoon.
Yeah, so if you're not willing to have it on a billboard on the N1...
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that they're fairly ignorant ideas about the right to freedom of expression. Certainly, I saw in the reaction to the FNB firing of those employees on that WhatsApp group.
Yes.
You know, there were, I think, 4 people on that WhatsApp group, and the sentiment around the country seemed to have been, but what about their right to freedom of expression? Mm. And I think we need to get the message out there that the right to freedom of expression is a fundamental constitutional right. You know, it's at the moment, I would go so far as to say it's the cornerstone of our democracy, mm-hmm. given what's going on in South Africa at the moment. But it's not an unlimited right. You know, by that I mean my right to freedom of expression can be limited when it comes into conflict with other people's rights. For example, when it comes into conflict with your right to privacy or your right to dignity or your right to reputation. Or, very importantly, if I've signed a contract which limits my right to freedom of expression. So if you have a contract of employment, for example, You have a duty to act in the best interests of the company you work for.
Yeah.
And sometimes that means that you can't say what you'd like to say because it's not in the best interests of the company that pays your salary. And ideally in South Africa, don't bite the hand that feeds you.
So, but I don't have it plastered on my bio, for instance, that I work for X company.
Yeah. You know, so many people have these sort of so-called disclaimers, and I really am very nervous of any, I tweet in my personal capacity or I work at X company, but these views are my own. I think if anything, often those disclaimers, and I say it in inverted commas, it heightens your obligations to the company because, you know, you say I work at X bank, but these views are my own. And then if the first tweet below that has the K word in it, well, I don't even have to go and interrogate and look at your LinkedIn account and see where you work, because you've clearly brought the company into disrepute by your content. So I hate those disclaimers. I think that anybody who thinks it's a magic wand which will absolve you from any liability should probably read one of our books.
So it provides no protection whatsoever, having
no
this caveat saying.
Absolutely no protection. I think that the starting point, as it must always be, that you are who you are in the real world when you go online. All the same real world duties, obligations, contractual duties, you know, professional codes of conduct, industry regulations, anything that applies to you in the real world, I would say not just applies equally online. I would actually go so far as to say applies more so online because everything we put online is so public and so permanent.
Right.
The screenshot, let me tell you, if you get it wrong, there's somebody who's taken a screenshot. And once the screenshot has been obtained, then it's there forever. And that forms a very public, very permanent record of what you've said.
No, and it's been said that whatever's online is there forever.
Absolutely. You know, I talk when I speak to the children, I talk about the tattoo effect of the internet. And it really is, it can be a very, it can be an awful thing because I've had clients who've come to me, often victims of revenge pornography, people who have either sent naked pictures or filmed themselves having sex or even without their consent and without their knowledge being filmed having sex and that content lands up online. And then you Google that person and then suddenly all these porn sites come up. So I've actually had to advise some clients in the past to change their names because it's the only way that you can escape that kind of content that comes up.
To legally go to Home Affairs
at least
and initiate action to change your name so you can get away from an online profile.
Exactly. You know, I've had clients who've had to do that, but I've also had clients who've just changed their name professionally, you know, change their email address at work, change the name by which they go at work, because that really is the most important thing. You know, if I'm going to have a meeting with Joe Bloggs, I'm going to Google Joe Bloggs before that meeting, and if all the stuff that comes up is of him on porn sites. You know, we also battle with what we call the Barbara Streisand effect, which is when something is online, the more you try and take action to delete that content, the more people land up finding out about it and land up seeing it. Do you remember when that the Spear of the Nation, that picture was hanging in the Goodman Gallery?
Yes.
And that picture had been there for 8 days and had been published to a fairly contained art-loving public in South Africa. Jackson Mthembu released a statement 8 days later saying the ANC is going to interdict and we're horrified and we're so upset about it. And literally the whole world saw it. It was on the front page of the New York Times the next day. And that's often the risk we take in deciding whether or not to take legal action, because sometimes the practical considerations outweigh any legal options available.
I want to come back to the employee-employer relationship, right? And some of the restrictions or policies that we have to be mindful of. A lot of organizations do take steps to have policy in place. That's usually the first line of defense, that we expect you to behave in this manner. And then on the other hand, you have people feeling that they need to be able to express themselves. And you say that that is not enough. You always have to be responsible to your organization regardless.
Yeah, absolutely. As a rule of thumb, if you wouldn't stand up in front of all of your colleagues and say it, or put it on the billboard next to a huge photograph of your face, your name and the name of the company you work for, then don't say it on any sort of social media platform, even something that feels like a private social media platform. Now, as I think of it in two categories, and I think that sometimes lawyers, when we speak about law, we complicate it. I think it suits lawyers sometimes to make law very mysterious, so you have to pay lawyers lots of money to get them to explain it to you. But it's actually quite simple. If we can remember two rules, the first is don't bring the company into disrepute. Don't do anything that makes it look bad that a company is prepared to be associated with you. Now, the rules of the game have changed somewhat because that can be how you behave at work, but it can also be what happens when you're out watching rugby on a Saturday night drinking brandy and coke with your friends that somebody films and puts on YouTube and says, look at this X company employee. We saw it, for example, with Lance O'Leary a couple of weeks ago with that road rage incident. Outside of work hours, outside of work premises, but still has enormous potential to hurt the reputation of the company because you're associated with the company. The second category for me is much more interesting because it's where you bite the hand that feeds you.
Right.
You know, there's a common law compulsion in South Africa to always act in the best interests of the company that you work for. So what that means is you can't go home and put on Facebook about how much you hate your boss and how incompetent your colleagues are. And, you know, even if it's true and you've got all the evidence to show that what you're saying is true, you can't say it because it's not in the best interests of the company that you work for. And that's the one that doesn't sit so obviously, I think, with some people, because what I'm saying to you is that you can't say something that all in all other instances you'd be able to say because it's not in the best interests of the company you work for.
That brings into the conversation the question of privacy, but we'll come back to that. I first want to maybe stay with this company situation. Say our company does something and we're not allowed to comment on it. Mm. And someone goes ahead and comments. Mm. That can be a fireable offense. But say X company does something and you have a particularly different opinion. Mm. Isn't that infringing on your rights to freedom of expression to express
it is
on a platform said view?
It is, but it's an absolutely valid restriction. Mm. So I think also maybe we need to warn people against taking a media company like this one as the model, you know, because there have been instances where Prime Media, for example, has been in the news over a particular controversy and presenters have come on air and talked out about that.
Right.
You know, I think you've got to really appreciate that there's a slightly different rule that applies for the media. But if you worked for one of the banks, for example, and suddenly there's big news that this bank has been referred to the Competition Commission because they've been involved in price fixing and it's a, you know, and then one of your employees goes on social media the next day and says, oh, I'm so embarrassed that I work for such an unethical company. This is just so awful. I can't believe I have to go to work this morning. Mm. What they're saying is true. It is an unethical company, but you're biting the hand that feeds you. It's not in the best interests of the company that you work for. And therefore, the CCMA will find that that is a valid restriction of your right to freedom of expression. You know, sometimes I think it's easier to think of it like a sponsorship contract.
Mm-hmm.
So say, for example, I'm sponsored by KFC. Then what that means is I mustn't go and tweet about how much I love Nando's, right? Because that's pretty obvious to us, right?
Yes. Hand that feeds you.
Because do you know what I mean? Mm. So sometimes when we think about it like that, it's so obvious. Well, you know, this particular chicken company is paying me to be sponsored by them. I'm not going to go and tweet about or go and tweet that I don't like, you know, so say KFC sponsors me and I say, oh, well, I don't, you know, I actually don't really like KFC chicken and I think it's super unhealthy. That's biting the hand that feeds you, you know, so that it's pretty obvious when we think of it in terms of a sponsorship contract. I think what we need to do is think about that in terms of our employment contract as well.
So I can't then go and say something about a client to our business.
Mm. Absolutely. So it extends specifically to big customers, big clients, big suppliers. I'll give you an illustration. I spoke at a law firm about a year ago, big law firm, and one of the employees, one of the quite senior lawyers actually, came to me afterwards and she said, you know, I think I may have messed up, because she said she'd been banking with one of the big banks, let's call it X Bank, for a long time.
Yeah.
And she'd been getting abominable service from them. I mean, really bad. She was at her wit's end. So she was writing complaints on Hello Peter and she was writing on social media, on Facebook, warning all her friends against using this bank. And she actually at one point even said that she wouldn't let her dog bank with this bank, right? But they're sitting there thinking about it. Actually, that bank is the single biggest client of the law firm that she works for. And could this be a problem?
Mm.
And then it becomes quite obvious, you know, but I think for some reason, there's something quite personal about social media. It feels much more like we're sitting around a dining room table having a glass of wine with a friend, especially the WhatsApp groups.
Yes.
And not that we're publishing on the front page of the newspaper next to the name of our company. And that's what we've got to think about. Mm-hmm. That as soon as content's been seen by one other person, we treat it legally as if it's been published on the front page of the newspaper.
Oh, this means we're going to have to really change our approaches. I want to talk about privacy. We're going to tackle the question of children. There's an interesting way of tweeting around the policing that our new minister seems to have embarked on. And I'm really curious about some of those ramifications there. If you have any other questions, do give us a call. 011-883-0702, 31702 for your SMSs, because social media, the way we post, what we post, can have severe legal implications. And what exactly are those? We're chatting to Emma Sadlier this afternoon in the Masterclass. Back with Emma Sadlier as we explore some of the legal implications to our use of social media. Emma, the example that you made earlier on brings about questions around privacy, our sense or idea of what privacy is, particularly on certain platforms like WhatsApp, where you think that this is a private moment that I'm sharing with a couple of friends and that there is trust within this group. And so I'm safe. I can say whatever I need to say.
Absolutely. You know, privacy in the digital age is actually just a fascinating thing to think about. speak every day to various audiences, and I always say to them, you know, what is privacy? Mm. What does privacy mean to you now? You know, do you think privacy is dead? And a lot of them say, yeah, that's it. Privacy is dead. And then I say, well, I get furious when people tell me that privacy is dead, because I can tell you that if I'd woken up this morning and there were naked pictures of me on the front page of the newspaper, or if somebody had published my confidential medical information, my HIV status, my financial information, you know, for everybody it's different. I think we've all got different ideas of privacy. Mm. But of course, privacy still exists. I do appreciate that the privacy analysis now is totally different to what it was pre-social media, which we're only talking sort of 10, 13 years ago. You know, Facebook is a company that's 13 years old. Mm-hmm. So it's a totally different analysis now, but it still exists. So the South African legal test is this. If you can show that you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in a particular set of circumstances, right, and somebody infringes it, then you can sue them.
Right.
It really just means, is this moment private? Mm. You know, if I'm standing naked in my bedroom, I've got a higher expectation of privacy than when I'm standing on stage fully clothed in front of 3,000 people, even if the person taking it is taking it with the same camera and it's the same subject and it's the same photographer.
Yeah.
You know, so what that legal test means is that the more you look after your privacy, the more of it you have.
So if I lock my page, Twitter allows you to lock your mm-hmm. page, that anybody who wants to follow you, you make a decision whether to allow them or not. Instagram does that too. So if I lock my page, does that say I have a reasonable expectation of privacy?
Certainly a much higher expectation of privacy. So say let's talk about Instagram. Say both of us are on Instagram and you've got an open account and you just treat the whole thing like a popularity contest, right? You hashtag the hell out of everything. You don't care who's following you as long as somebody's following you. And I might say that this is a big problem that we're seeing with the children, because particularly teenage girls treat the whole platform like a popularity contest, and that whoever's got the most followers is definitely the coolest. You know, I had an 11-year-old girl who came to me last week and she said, oh, ma'am, they call me ma'am. That's all I know. I've got old. She's like, ma'am, I just joined the 100 Club. So I was like, that's great. You know, what does it mean? She said, 100 people liked one of my photos on Instagram. So she was part of a whole different social club at school because 100 people had liked her photos. And you'll see it with particularly the teenage girls. If they Instagram a photo and they don't get enough likes, then they delete that picture. And there have been some very cool studies just done in the UCLA in America. Mm-hmm. Where they have shown that the self-esteem of a girl, of a child, is really entirely determined by how many people follow them, and that if they Instagram the same picture and they get a lot of likes, they'll feel like they look much more beautiful in that photo, compared to if they Instagram the same picture and they get less likes, then they feel like they're uglier in that photo. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty interesting. Anyway, so say you've got this open account, public account, you use hashtags, no privacy settings. The way I treat Instagram is that I've got a very private account. I'm very careful about who I let follow me. My rule is that if I wouldn't invite you for dinner, I'm not going to let you follow me on Instagram.
The good news is Facebook.
I'll invite you for dinner. Anyway, so let's say that tomorrow morning we both wake up mm-hmm. and on the front page of the You magazine, they've taken a photo from your Instagram account and they've taken a photograph from my Instagram and they've published them.
Yeah.
I could sue that publication for infringing my privacy, because I've got an expectation of privacy over my content, but you can't, because you don't have an expectation of privacy. There may be intellectual property issues, but from a privacy law point of view, that's what we're dealing with.
Wow. Let's go to the lines. Please put your headphones on. Don't forget, the lines are open to you. You can tweet us. It's at @Azania_ and at @Radio702. 31702 for your SMSs and your calls on 011-883-0702. Alan, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, Alan.
Oh, hi there. Yeah. Just a quick one. I was curious about forwarding links to copyrighted material. Let's say there's an article somewhere and I like it, and I copy the link and I forward it to all my social media buddies. Mm. And I would assume that's not violating any rules. But if it's too long and I copy a couple of paragraphs out of it, I say, hey, read this, came from there. And I announce with somebody copyright then or not.
Okay. Hi, Alan. Generally, where you're linking content, there's absolutely no problem, because you're linking to the original content and the IP holder will still get the benefit of that person going to click on that content. Mm-hmm. But where you're just taking excerpts of the content, what the Copyright Act says in South Africa, and bearing in mind we're dealing with a very old law that could never have foreseen that we'd be communicating the way that we do now, then provided you say where you got it from and the author, if it appears on the work, then you may use that copyrighted material. It falls within the fair use defense. So
if it's too long and I copy a couple of paragraphs out of it, I say, hey, read this, came from there. and I now screen with somebody copyright then or not.
Okay. Hi, Alan. Generally, where you're linking content, there's absolutely no problem because you're linking to the original content and the IP holder will still get the benefit of that person going to click on that content. Mm-hmm. But where you're just taking excerpts of the content, what the Copyright Act says in South Africa, and bearing in mind we're dealing with a very old law that could never have foreseen that we'd be communicating the way that we do now, then provided you say where you got it from and the author, if it appears on the work, then you may use that copyrighted material. It falls within the fair use defense. So absolutely no problem.
All right.
The relationship, it's a social media.
Mm-hmm.
It's a relationship.
All right. Is there any kind of accountability?
Yeah, John, this is an issue that I deal with in my practice literally every single day. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that I would go so far as to say that sexting has become a social norm in South Africa. Mm. It's not unusual. It's starting younger and younger. I used to say from 14, I just dealt with a case last week of an 11-year-old sexting. The youngest I've dealt with so far was a 9-year-old sexting. And, you know, I don't think it's even sexting there. I think it's more sort of taking the doctor play online. But sexting between adults is totally legal, provided both parties consent. It, of course, comes with huge issues because so often that content is misused after it's been sent in breach of somebody's privacy, in breach of somebody's dignity. You know, the idea that I send it to you means that I can send it to you, not that you can send it to all of your mates or put it online, or when we break up, put it on a revenge pornography website, or even worse, once I've sent material for you to say, well, pay me 5,000 rand to my e-wallet, or I'm going to put this online. Always happened to a client of mine a couple of weeks ago. If you don't send me 5,000 rand on e-wallet, I'm going to send it to your 12-year-old son who I'm following on Instagram and all of his friends who I'm following on Instagram. And this is somebody who'd been involved in a relationship, online relationship, admittedly, with this person for 8 months. Oh. So a lot of these sort of baddies have a lot of patience.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're dealing with anyone under the age of 18, it's an entirely different ballgame.
Yeah. And I want us to explore that terrain much further. We've got some questions on SMS as well as Twitter. And I think we will start to delve into some of the things you touch on in your latest book, Emma, because we'll be talking about children particularly and what we can do to protect them in this digital age. And the book is called Selfies, Texts and Smartphones, Teenagers Online Survival Guide. But for continue our conversation with Emma Sadlier, she's written a new book along with Lizzie Harrison. It's called Selfies, Sexts and Smartphones, A Teenager's Online Survival Guide. And of course, the previous book, Don't Film Yourself Having Sex and Other Legal Advice for the Age of Social Media. And we're just trying to understand the implications around the sort of posts that we put out, the communications that we just take for granted on different platforms, including WhatsApp. Now, Emma, we promised to address this issue of social media when it comes to children, because there are lots of risks that exist for our children. Firstly, as you said, that this is a CV that will remain with them for the rest of their lives. And they must be careful of what they put out.
It's an issue that's garnering international attention. I mean, it made the Queen's speech this year, for example, that children have to be able to live down their past. You know, we all did stupid stuff. You've got to push the boundaries as you're a teenager. You're trying to work out who you are. You are going to get it wrong. And the problem is that when I said flippantly right at the beginning that everybody's become a celebrity in the digital age, it's true. You know, when Prince Harry used to go out to a nightclub, he had to worry about not getting too drunk because somebody would take a picture of him and it would land up in the tabloids.
Yeah.
And now we all have that reality that the second any of us do anything remotely embarrassing, obscene, somebody's taking a picture of it. You know, videos that were circulated after Matric Rage last year of one girl who got particularly drunk and started doing a strip show for everybody, that video went viral. You know, they're those kinds of issues. So looking after not just what I call your digital footprint, which is what you're uploading about yourself, much, much more difficult for these poor children is looking after what I call your digital shadow, which is what other people are uploading of you. And the only way you can really do that is to manage what content exists. And teaching children that it's not your friend's human right to take pictures of you. If you don't want that picture to be taken, if you wouldn't put it on a billboard next to a huge photo of your face, your name and the name of the school you go to, then don't let the photo exist.
You're right.
You know, if you wouldn't put it on that billboard, if for example, there's evidence of underage drinking or smoking or, you know, I'm afraid the reality is that children are going to get it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to make sure that that evidence isn't obtained and taken with them. And that can, I mean, obviously that's more illegal content, but just general sort of anything that would look bad for their online CV.
Right, because bullying has always been there, but now we have cyberbullying possible on these platforms. So this material, the pictures, the evidence of all of these, all of this kind of behavior, it's possible for it to end up there and be used to bully you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the two biggest issues that I see without fail at every single school in every every province in South Africa, the two biggest issues are cyberbullying and sexting. The cyberbullying is much, much worse than it ever used to be. Firstly, it's often anonymous. You know, people hiding behind the screen. We all know as adults how much easier it is to say something terrible to a screen rather than to the face of a crying person. I see it with my own friends. Say things on Facebook that I know they wouldn't say if it was just the two of us in a room together. But there's something about going online that emboldens us, enables us to think that suddenly the real world laws and consequences don't apply to us.
Yeah.
So the bullying is anonymous. It's very public. So if somebody had called me a slut at school, I would have been beside myself. But the only people who would have known about it or heard it firsthand would be the five people who overheard it.
And by the time it gets to 15 people, it's become something else.
Exactly. But now, because it's happening publicly, everybody sees it at school. Everybody at other schools sees it, and it's permanent. You know, the torment of 24/7 bullying, the idea that you can't escape it. Even if you were being bullied nonstop, call it 10 years ago, you could still leave school for the, you know, at the end of the school day, get out of your school uniform and forget about it for the night or for the weekend. And now it follows these children. And I think, for that reason alone, parents have to exercise some kind of device management. I'm horrified how young children are getting smartphones in South Africa and how they're allowed to have them pretty much 24 hours a day. You know, I say it every talk I give, who here is allowed to sleep with their cell phone next to their bed? And invariably, from about 11 years old up, these children are allowed to have their phones with them at all times.
Yeah.
And it's just a disaster for all sorts of reasons. You know, if they've got their phones when they go to bed at night, they're on them. They're talking to their mates. They're listening to music. They're playing games. They're arriving at school absolutely exhausted. The ADHD issues are significantly worse than they've ever been before. So you know, cyberbullying is by far the biggest, you know, of the sort of the harassment issues that we see now. And then the sexting issue, you know, I said it, that I think it's become a social norm. It's normalized. You know, these children are being exposed to pornography earlier and earlier. The average age of first exposure to pornography in South Africa is 11. I think at many schools it's younger than that. But in simple terms, as soon as your child has a smartphone, they're looking at pornography.
Yes.
There's nothing really you can do to stop it. You know, they're inquisitorial by nature, and they will always be interested. And, you know, it's not the first time most of my friends were exposed to pornography. It was in a Playboy magazine of, you know, maybe a naked girl, and fairly innocent, actually, if you compare the kind of pornography that's so easily available for everybody. And the children are growing up thinking that a lot of what they're seeing is normal. And South Africa is still a very conservative society. So, you know, we don't talk about it. And we don't talk about the fact that when an 11-year-old boy sees pornography, hardcore, you know, often very violent pornography, they think that that's what sex looks
is,
like.
Absolutely.
And we need to be having that conversation to make sure they understand that that's not what it looks like. And we see it coming through in their behavior towards asking for nude pictures. There's at the moment particularly huge pressure being placed by the boys on the girls from a very young age to send these naked pictures. And no doesn't mean no when it comes to sexting. No seems to mean persuade me or ask me again. I've had children land up in hospital having tried to commit suicide. There was one girl in particular that I was thinking of who was asked 56 times by one boy for a nude, and she said no every time. And he kept asking and he kept asking and he kept asking. And, you know, it's almost like, well, if you don't send it to me, obviously you don't like me. You know, there's this sentiment that you must be very prudish, or you're not into me if you're not going to send it. And the nudes are being treated as, I say nudes. That's what the cool kids call naked pictures. You're not allowed, you know, if you're talking to a teenager, you got to call it nudes. So the nudes are being treated as a social currency. It's almost like a modern day, football card. You know how we used to go and buy the cards at the garage? That seems to be, it's like a competition. Who can get the nudes the quickest? And then let's send them to all of our friends as soon as possible. You know, it seems to be that kind of competition. And there are a lot of terrible things that are happening as a consequence.
What are the legal implications? And also, where do the parents come in? And I'm not sure where our laws stand, because as a parent, I've given my child, who is sending another child, 55 requests, 56 requests for nudes.
So I suppose we need to go back to John's question, because we answered about the sexting between adults. That's legal. Anytime you're dealing with a child under the age of 18, it's dealt with under our child pornography laws in the Films and Publications Act. And basically it criminalizes anything to do with the creation, the manufacture, the solicitation, the sending, the possession, the distribution of child pornography. What that means is that if somebody asks your child who's under the age of 18 for a naked photograph, it's solicitation of child pornography. Just the request is a criminal offense.
Even if they're a minor themselves.
Even if they're minor themselves. This is important, Azza, because in South Africa, under our Child Justice Act, if you're under the age of 10, you have no criminal capacity. That means you can't be arrested. If you're under the age of 10 and you commit an offense, you kill somebody, you can't be arrested and charged with murder. Over the age of 14, however, you have full criminal capacity. So that means that a 14-year-old is capable of committing exactly the same crimes that you and I are capable of committing. Mm. And the NPA does prosecute these children between the ages of 10 and 14, which is a lot of children that we speak to and a lot of the children getting it wrong on social media. Right. There's a presumption that they don't have capacity, and that really does mean, you know, do they have the ability to know the difference between right and wrong? Can they appreciate the consequences of their actions? But what the prosecution will do is that they look at that particular child between the ages of 10 and 14 and they say, how mature is this child? How clever are they? How educated are they? What kind of school do they go to? What kind of family do they come from? Mm. And if they're mature enough to understand, or should be mature enough to understand, then they will be prosecuted even if they're under the age of 14. But over the age of 10. So children need to know this.
Yeah. And the parents?
And the parents, so in some jurisdictions, the most recent one that I'm aware of was Victoria in Australia, have passed specific laws that allow, that hold parents liable for every single thing that their children are up to on their cell phones up to a certain age, usually 13,
right,
which is fascinating. Generally, no, in South Africa, the parents are not responsible for what the children are up to. There is a reporting duty. So if you know that your child is the victim of a sexual offense, or if the school knows that an under 18-year-old is the victim of a sexual offense, you have a duty to report it to the police station. Now, even the transmission of pornography under the Sexual Offences Act, if you send or show pornography to somebody under the age of 18, you are guilty of a criminal offense. But the person who's under the age of 18 who you're showing or sending that pornography to is the victim of a sexual offense. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a very, very old law being translated into a very new way of living. You know, we couldn't have foreseen that we'd be communicating the way we do now. And it makes sense to us that it was a criminal offense for a dirty old pedophile to be showing pornography to our child.
Yeah.
But the translation of that law now means that if a 14-year-old boy sends his 14-year-old friend pornography, the person who sends it is guilty of committing a criminal offense. The person who receives it is the victim of a sexual offense.
Right.
And the school and the parents have a duty to report it to the police station.
Hmm. And I wonder how many actually do, even aware whether or not of this obligation. Emma, let's go to the calls now. We've got, is it Taryn? Taryn in Pretoria?
Taryn, yes.
Hi, Taryn.
Hi, how are you, Azania?
Very good, thank you. Welcome to the masterclass.
Yes, I just want to say I'm in a pair, and it's really worrying for me to see that the grade five girl that I am a pairing for she's got access to her phone after hours, and even though her parents are really conservative, they're Christians, I don't think they really know what she's doing on the phone. She has a limited amount of things that she can do on the phone, but internet is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And even children of her own age, I see the kids with the smartwatches and so on, even at school. And I think it's worrying to have children at the age of 10 and 11 easily being able to access their phones.
Mm.
It's really something that has to be...
Yes.
Yeah, somebody has to say something about that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Taryn. And we've got other people commenting on that as well. Barry John Feynman says, can relate. I work with the youth group in the East Rand, and some kids are constantly bombarded for nudes, speaking of that pressure. And another one from Oliver says, biggest issue for me on social media is people who just put their young kids out there for likes. And Tiamo just acknowledging that she has so much stress listening to this conversation about potentially what her children are exposed to. There was an earlier question from Sam saying, posting pictures of our kids on social media, could it be seen as an invasion of their privacy?
So both, well, actually all very good questions.
Mm-hmm.
If I can just go back to Taryn, I think we should get her a bells.
Yeah.
You know, I really am so nervous of these parents who give their children cell phones, and not just a dumb phone, you know, an old Nokia that can make phone calls and SMSs, smartphones at a very young age, you know, and depending on which school they go to, there's enormous social pressure to get these phones. So my very strong view, and I'm starting a nationwide campaign,
yes,
as of this minute.
Emma, with this movement, hashtag.
That smartphones should be banned for children under the age of 13. There is absolutely no reason that a child under the age of 13 needs a smartphone. The only reason is the social pressure, mm-hmm. because it's a bit like sending your child to school with, I was going to say, an unsavory kind of footwear, which is probably not allowed on radio. But, you know, it's that social pressure of you can't send your child to school because they're the only ones in the whole class that doesn't have a smartphone and therefore they're going to be socially excluded. Mm. You know, so if that's the only reason, then let's take away that reason. Let's all get together and say we're not going to give our children smartphones under the age of 13. If they need a phone so that you can contact them, they can get hold of you in an emergency, buy them a dumb phone. There's no need for a smartphone. Smartphones have screenshots, they have cameras, they have internet access, which means that they're publishers. Mm-hmm. And as we've discussed, mm-hmm. once you're a publisher, you have instant access to an international public permanent platform.
Right. Let's take a break and we'll come back to more of your questions. There's plenty to get through and we'll try and get through as many as possible. We've got a couple of questions for my guest, Emma Sadler, as part of today's masterclass. Sam had asked a question about whether or not posting our kids' pictures on social media could be an invasion of their privacy.
Mm. Yeah, so this is such an interesting question. And I think South Africa is very far behind the international conversation on this. Yeah, you know, we mentioned a while ago, Azza, that the more you look after your own privacy, the more of it you have. We've also got to remember that as parents, we're dictating the privacy rights of our children, that the more we share about them, the less right to privacy they have. So if we look at some international examples, somebody as famous as J.K. Rowling, you know, she's one of the most famous people in the world, mm-hmm. author of Harry Potter. She has never shared a photograph of her children on social media. And that means that if the Hello magazine publishes a family photo, the faces of the children must be pixelated because she's created an expectation of privacy for her children. Now compare that to Kim Kardashian. Kardashian's poor children, North and Saint. Mm-hmm. And I suppose a good new recent example would be Serena Williams, you know.
A whole
She's got an Instagram account. Mm. I'm a big fan. I'm a fangirl for Serena Williams. I'm following that account of her child. Don't you worry. But it does mean that if the tabloid press suddenly publish all the photographs of her children, she can't turn around and say, but what about my child's right to privacy?
Right.
Because she hasn't nurtured and looked after that privacy right.
Okay.
And, you know, in Germany, the police have called. It hasn't happened, but the police have called for a nationwide ban on parents sharing any photographs of their children on social media.
Wow.
And actually, what a lot of people will be surprised about is that the number one reason that they talk about as to why parents should be banned from sharing these pictures is not sort of what you would expect, pedophiles and safety and all this. They go on to that, but actually embarrassment. And it's very true. When friends go to my parents' house for lunch on a Sunday, for example, and they're the pictures of me looking like a real crime scene with mousy hair and pimples and braces. And, you know, I don't want everyone seeing that. Let me tell you. But the thing is, we're letting our children inherit this digital footprint that they didn't ask for.
Hmm.
And in France, they've taken it a step further. In France, they've passed a criminal law which will allow children as they get older to lay criminal charges against their parents if they feel like their parents haven't sufficiently looked after their privacy and image rights when they were younger. So I think, you know, for me, I don't think that the rule should be no child should have a digital footprint. Mm-hmm. I think parents must be very conscious that these companies that you're putting all your content in the hands of owe you nothing. You know, Facebook, there may be privacy settings today. There's no guarantee that those privacy settings will exist tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, the test must be what happens if content lands up in the wrong hands.
Absolutely.
And particularly, you mentioned it earlier in the context of cyberbullying, digital manipulation. You know, that somebody can take that picture, and I wish I was just scaremongering here, but take that picture of your child, Photoshop the face onto a naked body and put it onto a child porn site.
Mm.
I'm afraid is a reality that I've had to deal with in my practice on a number of occasions. Really the appreciation that digital content is dangerous content and that we have to be very, very careful about who has access to digital content of us and of our children.
Okay, let's go to Vivian in Bryanston. Hi, Vivian.
Hi, Azania. Hi, it's Vivian. I'm calling from Bryanston.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question, Emma, if I could please ask you. My daughter goes to a very nice school in Bryanston. We recently had quite a horrible incident that happened. It's on a WhatsApp group situation.
Mm.
My daughter was on a WhatsApp group with a whole lot of girls from school, okay?
Mm.
About six girls. On a few of those girls on that group were bad-mouthing a particular girl at school.
Mm.
My daughter never commented or said anything about the things that were being said about this girl.
Yeah.
But they've all been called in by the headmistress to say they are all guilty by association. They were looking at going legal with this. My daughter, they had to publicly apologize to the grade and to the school. I just want to find out, is it the case that that my daughter would be guilty by association?
By being on the group, even though she didn't comment?
Yes.
Emma?
Vivian, such an awesome question. You know, we haven't had specific case law on this point, but I'll take you through the most similar case. It was a case that happened in the Pretoria High Court, and basically what happened was that a man was held responsible for content that he had been tagged in. So basically, this man had remarried a new woman, and this new wife had gone onto Facebook and called the ex-wife a pedophile, and in so doing, in writing this status, had tagged her husband. Now, the husband did nothing. He didn't like it. He didn't comment on it. He didn't share it. But crucially, he didn't dissociate himself. He didn't untag himself or comment disapprovingly. He just left it. So when the ex-wife sued for defamation, she sued both the new wife and her ex-husband. And the judge in that case said to the husband, but why didn't you dissociate yourself? You could have taken steps to dissociate yourself and you chose not to. And therefore you are responsible. Now that's completely fascinating for me because the way I interpret it, certainly for the WhatsApp groups. And you know, it's so funny because we hear Eusebius every morning talking about how somebody's on the same WhatsApp group. It means they've got the same views. This is a big youth culture and big Twitter thing at the moment. Somebody's on the same WhatsApp group. What it means is that if you're on a WhatsApp group, you do have the ability to dissociate yourself from content. You can say, hey girls, this isn't cool. We shouldn't be saying this. Or you can leave the group. And so my interpretation of that judgment is that if you don't, you're allowing your name to be coupled with that sentiment.
Right.
You've had the ability to dissociate yourself. You've chosen not to. And in my interpretation, you are as responsible as everybody else on that group.
Oh, Emma. Oh, so insightful. This book is coming out next week. It'll be available in stores. Vivian, do get the book. I recommend that every family has this book. Give it to your children. You read it. Share it with your children. It'll hopefully give them ideas on how to safeguard their footprints, their online footprints. Selfies, Sexts, and Smartphones, A Teenager's Online Survival Guide. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been such an honor being here. And I really urge parents, if you've got children and you're thinking about getting them a smartphone, or if they have a smartphone already, I think that you should treat this new book really as almost like the K53. Before you're allowed to drive a car, you have to get a license. And before you give them a smartphone, you've got to make them read this book, even if they find it very boring.
Can you start the hashtag already so we can follow and make a trend and make it a movement? We'll be backing you on that
one.
Thank
you for having me.
Thank you, Emma.